Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is Lieutenant Colonel Mike Jameson. Hi, Mike. Welcome back.
Hi, Rob. Oh, Lieutenant Colonel, I finally reached Henry Blake status.
You know, you're climbing the ladder, man. You know, you're climbing the ladder. That's how it works on the show. So thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, of course, you've been on the show many times before. As you know how it works. We're here to talk about the season five episode. It's episode 13, Hawk's Nightmare, a really great episode from season five. And that is saying something. The original air date was December 21st, 1976, written by Burt Prelutsky and directed by Burt Metcalf. A lot of Burts going on here. So, okay. Hawkeye seems particularly agitated during surgery, complaining about the shocking youth of his patients. He calls them babies and says they should be home getting burped by their mothers, not fighting in a war. At the end of a long session in a war, Hawkeye and BJ go to sleep. But a few minutes later, Hawkeye wanders out of bed across the camp, sleepwalking and acting like a small child to boot. The next morning, everyone asks him what he was doing the night before, and Hawkeye doesn't have the foggiest idea what they're talking about. At first, he dismisses the whole idea until Klinger mentions the name of a grade school principal Hawkeye talked about while miming playing basketball, which freezes Hawkeye in his place. Another day goes by, and in the middle of the night, Hawkeye wakes up again and goes sleepwalking. He reverts back to the same childlike identity he had the night before, miming playing basketball and shooting marbles. He wanders the compound until Radar and Klinger lead him back to his cot. This all seems harmless enough, but then things take a darker turn. Hawkeye has a blood-curdling nightmare about a childhood friend getting killed while sledding. BJ wakes him up, and Hawkeye finds himself sweaty with his heart pounding and a possibly soiled cot. The next day, Hawkeye tries to convince himself that it's just tension. He tries to make himself feel better by calling the childhood friend back home just to see if he's all right. He is, but the phone call degenerates into a shouting match when the friend insists that Hawkeye owes him $37. That night, Hawkeye is afraid to go to sleep, and he tries to get other people to stay up with him. At first, he tries Klinger, then Father Mulcahy, and then gets so desperate, he even tries to talk to Frank. When that peters out, he lays down and falls asleep. But sure enough, a little while later, he has another nightmare about a childhood friend being hurt, leading him to make another phone call. As Radar puts the call through, Colonel Potter asks Radar afterward to call Sidney Friedman. Sidney agrees to come visit the next day. Late at night the next day, Hawkeye, BJ, Colonel Potter, Radar, Father McKee, and Sidney are playing cards. One hand ends, and Hawkeye and Sidney take a walk outside, ending with them sitting outside the swamp. Hawkeye is clearly worried, terrified even, and he comes out and asks Sidney if he thinks he's going crazy. Sidney, who has been gentle with Hawkeye to this point, pointedly answers no. He deduces that Hawkeye is trying to get back to a time in his life where there were no life or death decisions, and that, on the whole, the dreams are peaceful. It's when the pain of being in war intrudes on them is when they turn dark. He reassures Hawkeye that this will pass, but reminds him that there's a lot of pain Hawkeye is dealing with, and it will take some time to pass. Hawkeye, feeling better, thanks Sidney for his help. Sidney responds by challenging Hawkeye to a game of mime basketball, the same kind Hawkeye had been playing all week. As they laugh and relax, Klinger and Radar watch from inside, amazed. Klinger now understands why his brand of crazy gets so little notice. All right, Mike, overall, what's your view of Hawk's Nightmare as an episode?
Well, you know that last season I was on and did Quo Vadis, Captain Chandler, which is one of the best Sidney episodes, one of the best episode theories, but one of the best Sidney episodes. So I felt like I had to come back and do another of one of the best Sidney episodes of the series. This is a great episode, and it's another one. It's a little bit. I feel like it is of the same kind of vintage as Quo Vadis, in that, you know, it's a little bit more serious. There are some very funny lines, but this is probably one of my, I don't know if it's top five. It's top 10. I mean, this is just a great episode, and I feel like with MASH, I mean, as you've said a lot of times, there are no bad episodes of MASH, but the later seasons of MASH, where they tended more toward the dramatic, it could seem like they were very on the nose with some of their more dramatic episodes or more dramatic leaning episodes. I feel like in season four and five, especially, that they were able to mix the drama and the comedy, but also not it's not that on the nose with the drama. I mean, this just, it just feels so naturalistic. And also, I always feel like I need to do a Sydney episode because I love Sydney so much. And he's, it feels like, and he's in this episode, I know we're, I'm jumping ahead already, but if he's in this episode for like 5 minutes, but
yep.
You know, you remember that 5 minutes. That's, you know, it feels like he's in it longer because of just the, I mean, it's Alan Arbus. So, you know, two lines by Alan Arbus are going to be two great lines. So, 5 minutes of Alan Arbus is going to be great. So there you go.
Yeah. I mean, Bert Prelutsky, who wrote this one, who also wrote Quo Vadis, Captain Chandler, yeah. Funnily enough, just had a knack for this show. He just did. I mean, I think virtually every one of his scripts, he only wrote about half a dozen, but every one of them at the very least are A-level episodes, maybe at their worst, like an A-minus episode, and some are A-pluses. So his batting average for the show was just off the charts good. And yeah, it's kind of funny when I think of this episode, I think of it as a Sydney episode, even though, as you just said, Sydney only shows up in the third act and only for a couple of minutes. And I feel like that says a lot about, first of all, the actor, Alan Arbus, that he was kind of willing to do an appearance on this show that's so relatively small. I could see a lot of actors kind of being like, well, geez, if I'm going to show up, can I do more? I mean, he just did the Dear Sigmund episode where he's in it from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And then Quo Vadis, he comes in about halfway through. But just as an actor, I think that's a kind of a generous spirit to say, yeah, I'll come in and just do, you know, 5 minutes on the show. And it's also it's much more realistic because, of course, in real life, people flit in and out of your life. And when they show up, they're not always the guest star of that day. You know, some people you run into them for 5 seconds, you know, that's something that's very realistic about life. And that, of course, living at the 477, people would come in and out of your life very quickly at times. And that's how life is. But that isn't always the way you have to produce a TV show because you're paying for the actor. But the fact that they would bring a heavy hitter like Sydney in just at the very end, I'm like, that's just so impressive that it would be like, okay, we've gone as far as we can with this story, with Hawkeye and the sleepwalking. Now let's bring in Sydney, just kind of clean all this up. And it's marvelous. Again, he dominates whatever episode he's in because he's just so good at this part.
Yeah, and I think it shows, again, you know, when you read books about MASH and stuff, and they said where they thought about adding Alan Arbus on as a regular cast member, just because it works that way. He can just come in and he just has that rapport with all the cast. Now, I don't think it would have worked if he was on. It just made it that much more special that, you know, he's on once or twice every season. But exactly. I mean, it works because he can come on. He had and the audience already knows him and feels comfortable with him, too. So like you said, I mean, he can come on for 5 minutes, just like in real life. It's somebody who's coming. It doesn't have to be. Again, you think of it as a Sydney episode, but it doesn't have to be a full Sydney episode. He can be on there for the 5 minutes, but that is what you remember about this episode is the 5 minutes of Sydney Friedman. So it is. It's just a testament. I mean, to go behind the curtain, I just listened to your podcast that you released today, the Dear Sigmund episode, and I'm trying not to repeat a lot of the platitudes that were said about Alan Arbus and Sydney as a character because, you know, he's amazing. He's great.
Yeah, it's hard not to. Yeah, I agree. Yep. I think Sydney as a regular wouldn't have worked. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I would have liked it if Sydney had showed up a little more. I think season two and this season are the only seasons off the top of my head where he appears twice.
Okay.
Because I think every other season he would just show up the one time. Mm-hmm. But in season two, they introduce him in Radar's Report and then they bring him back. Kind of the beginning of him as sort of a regular, and then here he makes two appearances. But I think going forward, he's only ever going to be in one episode. I would have been happy with like two or three a year out of 24 shows of Sydney.
But in our world now of the multiverse, there is somewhere where there are the where he does have his spinoff that we've talked
absolutely,
about.
Absolutely, yes, the Sydney aired multiverse. On CBS Mondays at 10. That show exists in the mold. I want the MASH multiverse where we go into that world. And Sydney ran 7 seasons on CBS after MASH went off the air. So the show opens in the scene, and in OR, and this is the only moment, and this is even the most minor criticism, but literally like the first line of the show is Hawkeye talking about how young the patients are, which is going to lead into the theme of how this is going to burr into his subconscious.
Right.
It's a little like on the nose. Like, I kind of wish they had given the characters three or four generic surgery lines before they got into that. Just a little bit.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It's funny because I was thinking the same exact thing. That is the only scene, the only couple of lines that don't sound natural. Like, it's you know, they're giving you the mission statement right there at the beginning.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
It's not terrible, but after watching it a million times, yes, it's something you could point out. So yeah, I agree with you. I was thinking the exact same thing.
Yeah, it's very, very minor. So then, of course, later that night, as I said, Hawkeye and BJ go to bed. Hawkeye gets up and he wanders out, and BJ wakes up and is sort of like, you know, you're all right? And he says, I'm going out. And he says, you know, Hawkeye says it in just enough of a sort of the way he would say it in, you know, when he's not asleep, that if you're BJ and you're half asleep, it sounds fine. It sounds normal. You don't really pay attention. And then he goes into post-op, and we see that, first of all, we get the sense it's the middle of the night. And Father Mulcahy is there reading to a patient, which I think is a nice touch, you know, that he's there helping out. And we see Frank and Margaret, and they are there on duty. And then there's this whole weird run with Burns about where he says, oh, Hawkeye's probably out tomcatting around, probably on the prowl for that nurse Abel. Able and willing is the way I hear it. Like, what? Frank, what the hell is he talking about? Like, and it was when you said that to Margaret. I suppose she didn't like slap him across the face. Like, what are you like, that's such a weird thing.
First of all, I don't know about you. I think this scene was always cut in syndication because I've watched this a couple times, you know, getting ready, and I do not remember seeing it that much except for, you know, when I finally got the DVDs and then watch it on Hulu. But I think Frank, especially this season, because he's so desperate for Mark, because what it devolves into, obviously, after, I think he thinks it's his way of turning the conversation onto something else. And it's, you know, it's Frank. So he doesn't know what he's doing.
I guess so. It just seems such a strange thing to kind of like be slut shaming nurse, to use modern parlance, to like, you know, to be doing that to Nurse Abel, especially to Margaret. You would think Margaret would just be like, shut your mouth, bird face. Like, what are you talking about? And yeah, this scene was always cut in, I get it, we've already talked about this. You and I probably saw the same syndicated version since we kind of grew up around the same area. So yeah, they cut this whole chunk out where Frank tries to hit on Margaret and she's not having any of it. And then he talks about her perfume and she says, oh, it's forbidden furlough. And when she rejects him, he says, you smell like a French hooker. So as you see, when Frank doesn't get what he wants, he just immediately turns on Margaret.
Two things. Mother's Day is coming up, so I want to see if they have forbidden furlough that I can buy for my wife. And second of all, I think this is kind of a weird episode. Well, not weird, but this is like there's one single storyline in this episode, and this is the only kind of side road that we take during this episode because the one single storyline is all of Hawkeye and the nightmares and stuff. So this is kind of like right at the beginning, it's kind of advancing the whole Margaret's engaged and Frank is still desperate for her. But I mean, other than that, then all you're getting for the rest of the episode is Hawkeye and what's going on with him. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's right. It's the only sort of sidetrack that we take during the whole thing. And like we were talking about, normally in the syndicated edit, it's the next scene that they jump right to, which is Hawkeye in the syndicated one. Hawkeye leaves the tent. He says, I'm going out. And then we cut to him playing the basketball in the courtyard. And that's when he gets discovered by Klinger. And he starts to talk about, I feel so late. I can feel forever. And he's talking about that he's got his new tennis shoes. And, of course, Klinger doesn't really understand what's going on. I mean, he's kind of giving Hawkeye a bit of a side eye, a little bit of like, well, because he's doing the mind basketball. But he doesn't understand exactly what is happening here. Now, have you, to your knowledge, Mike, have you ever sleepwalked?
I was just going to ask you. I have not. My son has.
Oh, really?
Yes. And that is the only experience I've ever had with it. It's been a few years since it's happened. So, I think 2 years. And it was only a few times, but that was the first time in my life. As far as I know, I've never been told I have. I've never have. My wife hasn't. But yeah, there was a couple months there about 2 years ago that my son was sleepwalking. And it is kind of like that, where I remember I was where I'm sitting right now talking to you. I was in my basement watching TV and my son just walked downstairs and literally started speaking like gibberish to me. He was talking, but I didn't know what he was talking about. And, you know, the first time I was like, what the, you know, I kind of led him upstairs to my wife, and we both were like, I guess he's sleepwalking, and then walked him back upstairs, put him to bed. And then the next morning he had no idea that he had done it. And then it happened like two or three more times. I mean, again, now in this day and age, you look online and you start seeing like what's going on. And I think it was funny because I think around the time that it happened, he was probably in third grade. So I think he was worried about like math that he was doing in school.
Oh.
He was fine, but I think he was just like feeling a little, he was a little bit worried about it. So, and that's what he told us. And we were like, okay, maybe that was causing him just to sleepwalk. And it happened two or three more times possibly over the next couple months. But you know, the most we were ever worried about it. It's funny because later in the episode, when Klinger says to Radar, don't wake him, we'll get lockjaw. There's always like those wives' tales of what'll happen. Like, you're not supposed to wake like somebody who's sleepwalking or something. And it doesn't, I don't think it matters, but it's just that, you know, they say you should just try to lead them back up the bed and put them to sleep. So, but you know, we were worried. Like, it's amazing when you think of it, because he walked down two flights of steps to come mm-hmm. to the basement. It's kind of crazy that he knew that I would be down in the basement watching TV at night. He knew where to find me. But yeah, and you think like he walked, and you just worry, like you don't want them to fall down the steps. Which never happened. But yeah, that was the only experience and it hasn't happened in 2 years, knock on wood.
Oh, but well, all right. Hopefully it won't happen tonight while we're recording this.
He might, you never know. But yeah, so that's the only experience I've ever had with anybody sleepwalking.
Okay, interesting. All right, yeah, I never have, as far as I ever know, as far as I've ever heard, I've never done it. So, it is a little, you know, eerie, because it's kind of like, well, how much of you is really there exactly? You know, I mean, you have enough wherewithal in your brain to, you know, move your legs back and forth and talk to people and do all this stuff, and yet you're not really there. And then, of course, right after Klinger walks away, Hawkeye propositions Nurse Baker, who is coming out of the mess tent with another nurse, and he doesn't know he's propositioning Nurse Baker because he's saying, do you want to play? And of course Nurse Baker is taking that in a, you know, as a double entendre, and you know, young Ben Pierce is not meaning it that way at all. And then he crawls back into bed, BJ wakes up, and then he even says, they even have this sort of, again, double entendre combination where BJ says strike out and Hawkeye says nobody to play with, and again, of course, he means that literally, and so then we cut to the next morning and Hawkeye's tired, and then Nurse Baker comes up to him and she says, you screwball, right in front of Nurse Ripley, next time you're in the mood to play ball, wait till she goes on duty. And she puts her finger up to her lips and kisses it and puts it on Hawkeye's mouth. I love Alan Alda's kind of Bob Newhart-y take there, where he's just kind of like looking like, what just happened? I don't understand. I am confused as to why any nurse would be scandalized that Hawkeye hits on them. Don't all the nurses know that at this point? Like, what is Nurse Ripley new? I don't understand.
She must have been. It's to advance the plot, obviously. But yeah, I mean, you would think they'd be used to it by now. And I'm glad that was a great description, the Bob Newhart look, because I love the look that the way he conveys that. What is she talking about? But I mean, I'm interested, but I just don't know what she's talking about. And it still freaks me out that's the voice of Velma.
Velma, yeah, that's right. It's Burt Metcalf. I love that as director, he kind of holds on that for as long as he does. You know, he just is like, Hawkeye's just, you know, it's like a full 3 or 4 seconds of just, what? You know, it's really great. It's a really, just, you know, get deadpan delivery. So then Hawkeye sits down at the table and he starts talking about that he's so tired. And then, of course, everybody's like, well, what do you expect? You were wandering around all night. And Hawkeye is like, what are you guys talking about? And Klinger saw it and Radar saw it. And, you know, he's like, you know, Hawkeye, of course, finds this completely ridiculous, and he thinks they're all just mistaken or whatever. And then that's when Klinger mentions, you mentioned some Vanderhaven somebody, and Hawkeye's like, I don't know any Vander somebody. And then he says, it was the new, your new principal. And that's what strikes Hawkeye, because Hawkeye is immediately Vanderhaven, you know, Clarence Vanderhaven, which, again, great old timey name.
Yeah, really.
For the principal. What other position could Clarence Vanderhaven have than that as a school has to be principal? Somebody,
yeah, it definitely has to be somebody from the 1930s.
Yeah.
And I do I love it because it's completely in character for Radar when he says, I just got a cold shiver up my back. To which Hawkeye says, so did I. But yep. I love that because you would think out of all of them that Radar would be the most superstitious or freaked out by that.
Mm-hmm. I love that Byrne says, geez, you may have been performing surgery in your sleep, which leads to one of the great lines of BJ saying, the voice of experience. It's great. The look of contempt he has for Burns on his Mike Farrell's face is just absolutely, he's just like, shut up, Burns. Just, you know, come on. So of course Potter tries to get to the bottom of it, and he says, you know, is there anything particular you're worrying about? And, you know, Hawkeye's like, no, I just may wake up tomorrow morning and you know, be wandering around the camp. And he talks about, I was playing basketball. And then Klinger tries to tries to alleviate the tension a little bit by talking about how good he was at basketball. And then we find Hawkeye in post-op talking to a patient, and we could see he doesn't look good. Like, he looks, yeah. He looks tired. The makeup's good. The actor playing the soldier, by the way, is named Sean Roche. This is his first ever acting credit. And he had a lot of TV credits like Police Story, The Walt, and St. Elsewhere. But he went on, actually, he's had a much longer career as an animation writer. I mean, he's literally written for dozens of animated TV shows like The Woody Woodpecker Show, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, Veggie Tales, The Real Ghostbusters, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Camp Candy. Wow. I mean, I was like, wow, I don't know how this guy wandered his way into this other career, but he's been very successful at it. So good for you, Sean Roche.
That's really good. And, you know, this is his first acting credit. He's very believable as, like, you know, the fresh-faced young kid. I mean, he makes me believe. I believe him as and I love his reaction. This whole scene is actually a really great scene. I love scenes where Hawkeye is describing Crabapple Cove. Mm-hmm. It makes me really, I'm kind of like the soldier. I wish it was a real, it's supposed to be in the show, but I wish it was a real place that I could go to. I'm supposed to go on vacation to New England later this summer. And in the back of my head, I'm always like, I want to go to Crabapple Cove and just drive through.
The good guy even says it sounds like a place that where Winnie the Pooh would have come from. And, you know, mm-hmm. And Hawkeye's like, yeah. And then there's this kind of great line about where he says, you know, the fall colors, the trees change their colors. It's beautiful. And then the guy goes, what about the people? And he says, they never changed color. Always the same. Off-white, which is not a nice little, you know, okay. Yeah, Crabapple Cove's not the most diverse town in the world. You know?
Yeah, I'm sure in 1950s, I mean, there was probably mostly off-white. But in that whole scene, I mean, that just goes to show where they can have something funny like that, but it also has one of my favorite lines of not only this episode, but I don't know why, of this series. And now, as a dad, it hits me more. But when he says, you know, the greatest man I ever knew grew up there and he never wanted to leave. And he says, who's that? And he says, my dad. And then when he says, how long has it been since you've seen him? And he says, a lifetime, 2 years. I love the way all the plays it. It's not with all the other stuff going on. It might not be that important, but I love that moment. The way he plays his relationship with his fictional father has always gotten to me throughout the whole series. I just think it's really underrated the way Alan Alda plays that all through the series. I mean, you could tell like the way that he loves his dad. So that's a great line.
Yeah. I always thought it was interesting as a character beat that Hawkeye very expressly has no heroes except his father.
Yep.
Like he kind of almost scoffs at the idea of having people to look up to. I mean, in the interview, he talks about that he doesn't look up to anybody. And then, but he worships his father.
Yeah.
And for someone as sort of doggedly unsentimental and adult kind of as Hawkeye, it's really charming that he has this one very childlike trait, which is the worshiping of his dad.
Yeah.
It's a very, very charming attribute that they gave Hawkeye. And yeah, I agree, the way that he says, you know, a lifetime, and then he just says 2 years, you know, and, you know, we're a reminder that only 2 years have passed in the lives of the characters, but we're watching year five of this show. But yeah, it's a great conversation. And this might be the first, I can't remember what the first time is where they finally move Crabapple Cove to Maine.
Yeah, you might be right.
Because it can talk about being right in Vermont, yeah. And then even as late as season four, he was saying it was our summer home. And then at some point, they finally just were like, no, that's where he's from, and that's it.
Yeah, you might be right, because that's right, in season four, in the late Captain Pierce, right? That's when he says that it was a summer cottage. Yeah, yep. You might be right. I think this is the first time that it's really established that it's his childhood home, yeah.
Yeah, and then they would have seen, they established later that Dr. Pierce never leaves.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that, okay, this, you know, he lives in this small town, he takes care of everybody, and he doesn't travel outside of that. So then we cut to later on that night, and Hawkeye is back to sleepwalking, walking around. This time he's playing marbles, and then we get into that bit where Klinger and Radar discover him, and Klinger says he's sleeping, and Radar's like, you know, go on, what do you mean? And then there's the whole thing, don't wake him up, he'll get lockjaw, which is, again, great. What a great superstitious kind of thing. I find it interesting that for the bulk of the scenes, Klinger is not in a dress for no discernible reason.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, maybe I almost said he was on a date, but I've seen him on a date with Darcy Kelly before in a dress, so.
Yeah,
maybe they were being washed. I don't know.
Yeah, right. I mean, sometimes I always wondered if like they weren't like testing him out a little, as like, can we just have him in a scene without it being the gag of being in drag? You know, can we just do him as a character, and how does it fly? And obviously, Jamie Farr, you know, crushed it in this role, so it works perfectly fine. And there's this great bit where Hawkeye calls Radar stinky. And, you know, because he's referring to him as an old friend, and Radar's like, you know, I really would prefer you not call me that, because that's the kind of name that really sticks on a guy. And then he calls him Dexter, and then Radar says, well, if I got to pick between the one or the two, I guess I'll go with Stinky. It's got a little more pizzazz to it.
Yeah, I don't know if that was a good decision on Radar's part, but okay, I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, because then, of course, Klinger calls him Stinky.
I love that action of I knew it.
I knew it. And then so Hawkeye goes back to sleep for just a moment, and then he starts having a nightmare. And there's this really great staging, I have to assume by either our cinematographer or by Burt Metcalf. But when Hawkeye starts yelling, and he's yelling kind of gibberish, and he's like, you know, it's kind of, you know, just kind of nonsense words. And BJ jumps up, climbs onto the bed, and kind of looms over Hawkeye, and there's the shadow of Mike Farrell, because the light is behind him, is covering Hawkeye. He's draped in shadow, and then when the shadow kind of passes over Hawkeye's face, we see Alan Alda looking as scared as he's ever looked on the show. And there's just something to me very powerful about the way that's revealed, is that we hear him yelling, and he's covered in shadow, and then we see his face very abruptly, and he's looking, you know, just absolutely terrified. And again, I don't know whether that was William Jurgensen, our cinematographer, or it was Burt Metcalf, but it's a great staging of the nightmare.
Yeah, and again, I mean, this is, I keep bringing up like later episodes. In the later episodes, you would see more of, this is Hawkeye, especially as a character that you see who's usually joking around. He's usually, you know, bad stuff happens, but he's usually laughing or, you know, so when you see him and just that look of like abject terror on his face, it like hits you. You feel what he's feeling at that moment. And everybody has had nightmares and stuff like that, or just waking up from a nightmare in your sleep. So, and like you said, you know, I mean, you really feel that moment when it happens.
My dreams, we're not going to get too far into it, because of course there's a whole dreams episode that we could talk about, but my dreams, when I've had nightmares, I don't have that many, luckily, but when I have had them, they tend to not be realistic. Like Hawkeye's dream is with actual friends on an actual location in Crab Apple Cove, Hermitage Hill, which they, again, a great name for for this place. But every time I've ever had a nightmare, it's I'm somewhere that I've never been, and it's with people I've never met, and it's a situation I've never been in. You know, it's not the whole, you know, I'm in college with no clothes on or anything like that. It's always just something that makes no sense at all. It's always just kind of complete gibberish. I've never had a nightmare like the one Hawkeye's described.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can imagine, I mean, even, you know, with something like that, you can wake up and just be like, all right. I mean, obviously while you're having it and right when you wake up. But I mean, if you're dreaming about people, you know, if it's family members or close friends, I mean, that would probably be, because I feel the same way. I mean, I don't think I've ever had like nightmares about, you know, people, family members or anybody like that. So yeah, it's usually stuff that once you're out of it, you're like, okay, it was a nightmare, but it was something that was completely bonkers. So it's not going to worry me, but you know, if you're having it and you know, it's almost lifelike and you're dreaming about the people who are close to you, it's got to be frightening.
Yeah, absolutely. So he talked about that he's shaking like a leaf and he says his heart is pounding, and we see that he's covered in sweat. And then he has the line and he says, my palms are sweaty and I'm not sure, but I think I wet the bed. And, you know, in the hands of another actor not as skilled as Alan Alda, that could come across as like a little funny. And it's not meant to be funny. It's meant to be deadly serious. And the way Alda delivers it is pitch perfect, because it's it's the last line in the act. And again, and you know, it could make that could make people uncomfortable and laugh a little when they're not supposed to. But again, the way Alda delivers it, the way he's just kind of startled, like, wow, like that's how bad this was. And it's a great line to end the first half of the show on.
Yeah, and you know, watching it, I always thought that he was just saying that, like you just said, trying to cut the tension. But you know what? Watching it a couple times, I'm like, he might actually mean it. And it's not meant to be a joke, and it's not meant to, you know, as a laugh line. It's meant to convey that that's how freaked out he is by this. So
yeah, absolutely, it's great.
And he sells it all the, like, again, I mean, what can you say? I mean, overall, these things, but like he does, he sells it that you believe it.
Yeah. So then we come back and we're back in surgery, and we see Margaret is, Margaret's actually trying to be comforting to Hawkeye. They're taking this seriously. And she says, you know, maybe it's a premonition, and, you know, Hawkeye's like, I don't believe in any of that stuff. And, you know,
That's what he tells her, I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. you know, and then he says, you know, look, the only green vegetables I get are martini olives. And then Hawkeye finally says, well, you know what? I'm going to call Toby Wilder, not because I believe in any of that clairvoyant stuff. But I just want to chat with an old friend kind of thing. Like, okay. And so he makes this phone call, and that turns, as I mentioned in the synopsis, it devolves into an argument about $37, which, again, in 1951 money, you know, not nothing, you know,
no.
It wasn't nothing. But I love, again, kind of bring you back to Bob Newhart, king of the phone call bits, you know, where you only heard his side of the conversation. And I have to think there was an actual actor on the other side of the line, because the way Alan Alda is a great actor. It's not a bulletin. It's not news to anybody. But the way he argues, the way he keeps, sounds like he's being interrupted. Where he's like, Toby, and it sounds utterly real that like somebody was on the other side of the line just trying to interrupt Alan Alda and making him do that. And he finally gets so money, so frustrated that he slams the phone down. And it's just a marvelous scene that, you know, he's trying to do something nice for this guy, and all this guy cares about, obviously he's been stewing about the $37 for like, what, 15 years at this point.
Yeah. But does it, I mean, that's, it establishes a friendship, because you know, you have friends like that who you would try to call them, you know, it might not be about money, but you're trying to call them about something serious, and they're, all they can do is bring up like, oh, you owe me money or something else. But I mean, I was going to bring that up too. I can't remember if I read it or saw it somewhere that, you know, some actors say it's hard where, you know, sometimes it is just them on the phone, and you have to act. Yeah, you know how you're supposed to be reacting to somebody who's not there on the other line. But then sometimes it is somebody who is feeding you lines through there. But yeah, he is. It's just great, because it makes you believe that this is somebody he knows and has known all his life, and is talking to. And it's just, yeah, it's like great reactions because it goes from him like trying to describe the dream and everything like that to just the mounting frustration of somebody on the other line telling him that he owes him money that he, you know, that he knows he paid him back. Yeah. And yeah, $37 in 1951 was, $37 now I would be asking somebody. So, you know, in 1951.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, I think 37 was like a couple of $100, you know, I mean, yeah. It's not nothing, but yeah, it's very funny that Toby just never forgave Hawkeye about it. It's just been stuck in his craw this whole time. He's just waiting for Hawkeye to call him. And then he finally, you know, so then Hawkeye wanders his way to the Oak Club again. It's clearly kind of late at night. He's talking to Klinger. Klinger's like, how'd you sure you paid him? And Hawkeye has this great line about, well, I always pay my debts. He says, except for Nudist Quarterly. I ordered that in Frank's name.
I wonder if that subscription lasted for the whole war. I wonder if he was still.
Yeah. Paying. Yeah. Did he order four? If you're using under somebody's name, order for 3 years. Why not? You know, what the hell? It's like, what we talked about, in the Colonel's Horse episode where Hawkeye, asks, Colonel Potter to ask Mrs. Potter to get the porno mags from. I love Nudist Quarterly. It's such a great name for a nudist magazine because it's got a, you know, by calling it a quarterly, it has a kind of like slightly serious newsy vibe. But then, of course, it's a nudist magazine. Now, Hawkeye talks about, well, you're not just another pretty face with leading to Klinger. Now, that's why we got Klinger in drag. It's probably just for that scene. It's just to have him in drag with the cigar and everything else. And of course, Hawkeye wants people to stay up with him because he's afraid to go to sleep. And, you know, that's not going to work. Klinger's like, you know, I got to go to, you know, good night, Captain. And as I, again, mentioned in the synopsis, Hawkeye is so desperate for company, he wakes up Frank.
You got to be company if you're waking Frank up.
Yeah, you are really hitting rock bottom at this point.
Can I ask you, I mean, I guess it's a personal question, when you were younger, I mean, I guess everybody when they're younger is a little bit, were you ever somebody who was afraid to go to sleep or like afraid of the dark or anything like that?
Not that I can really remember. I don't think my imagination ever ran away with me too much. Now I was going to mention, I was going to ask you because he mentions Burns mentions that he had a Popeye nightlight and his father took it away because Burns's father was apparently a complete piece of garbage.
I was going to say the adventures of young Frank Burns. He's not getting punched in the throat for
humming or whatever. Yeah. Garbage in, garbage out when it comes to the Burns family. But did you have a nightlight when you were a child? Because I did. I had a Batman nightlight. I remember.
I was going to say, it's funny that you mentioned that because I do believe that I had a Batman nightlight.
Oh, wow.
But my son right now, so he has a nightlight, but you know, it's not the same as when we were kids. His Batman nightlight, he has a whole Batman room, which nice. It's depressing me because he's going to be 11 next month. And I'm sure soon he's going to say, I don't want this stuff. He's got the big Batman sticker on the wall and the Batman sheets, but his Batman nightlight, this was a whole set. You don't just get the Batman nightlight. You get the actual big bat signal that you plug into the wall.
Wow.
He uses that as basically like a nightlight, but it's the bat signal.
Oh, that's boss.
Yeah, I know it is. I would have killed for this when I was a kid, this spoiled brat.
kids don't know how good they had it now.
But I had a Batman. I shared a room with my brother, but I was a wimp. I was afraid. I was somebody who was afraid of the dark. And I can kind of relate to Hawkeye trying to keep people up or wanting to keep people up because I didn't want to go to bed. I hated the dark when I was a kid. So I can relate to the trying to stay up later or get somebody to stay up. So yeah, I was like that as a kid. I'm a little bit better now.
Okay, good. Yeah.
The two cats keep me safe every night. I don't need them.
I love that bat signal. That's an amazing thing to have. My goodness. Yeah. I just had some little plug-in. I actually went looking for it on eBay just cause if I could recall, and I didn't see one that I immediately was like, oh, that was the one. I don't really remember what it was, but I'm pretty sure that's what I had.
Yeah, I know I had it. I wouldn't be able to remember either. I still have my Superman light switch like cover that went around the light switch from the 70s. I have that in a drawer somewhere, but I don't have the Batman nightlight that I had.
Gotcha. Yeah, again, kids don't know how lucky they Lucky they are now in this stuff. as you might expect, the conversation with Burns yields no dividends because Hawkeye mentions that Crab Apple Cove has 3,976 people in it, and Burns' only retort is Fort Wayne's bigger than that. What does that mean?
I've known people like that. Where, especially when you try, I've worked with people like that, where you say, like, you know what, I'm going to try to talk to these people, and maybe I'll give them I'm not giving them a fair shake. And they, and, you know, while you're talking to them, and they'll have some kind of reaction like that, in your head, you're just like, all right, yeah, I was right about them to begin with. I really don't need to talk to these people anymore. I do like, though, you said it pays no dividends. I will admit, though, when he does say to him, you know, his dad, it took away the nightlight and said that, you know, it was dark 12 hours out of 24 and he wouldn't have a son who was a coward half the time. And then, but he says to them, you know, there's nothing in the dark that isn't there in the light. He doesn't mean it because he's Frank and he's a buffoon, but I have actually used that line with my kids and just said, like, you know, if they were ever afraid of something, I'm like, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of. There's the same stuff that's there when it's light in the dark. So I don't think he meant it, because Frank is just an idiot and doesn't care about other people except for himself. But I was always like, yeah, that's not bad advice. Although I understand why Hawkeye says, you know, why doesn't that comfort me?
Yeah, because I find no comfort in that. Yeah.
But yeah, I find no comfort in that. But, you know, every once in a while, Frank kind of makes sense, even though he's
broken clock and all that. Really,
yeah, he's not trying to, but you know.
So then we cut to later on at night, and we hear more screaming, and again another little nice directorial touch from Burt Metcalf, where we hear the screaming, but we're on Frank, and the screaming is so loud that it wakes Frank up, and he grabs his overhead light and shines it in the direction of the screaming, and then there is a kind of whip pan over to Hawkeye, and he is filling the frame. It's a close up, and he's just screaming uncontrollably. And the light is kind of, it's almost, I don't want to oversell this, but it's a little, the way the light is kind of shifting off of Hawkeye's face and then shifting back. It's a little like the reveal of Mrs. Bates in Psycho, where they turn the thing around, and it's, spoiler alert, everybody, they turn Mrs. Bates around, and we see it's the skull, and Vera Miles smacks the overhead light with her hand accidentally, and all of a sudden, the shadows are crazy because it's swinging wildly. It's a little bit reminiscent of that. Again, a really nice touch by Burt Metcalf.
Yeah, the whole thing, I like that when he lays down, then they kind of do like an establishing shot almost of the swamp. And then you start hear the screams without seeing them, like you said. And then it cuts to Frank pulling the light. And then it also cuts to Potter, who wakes up hearing it. And I think that kind of conveys, like, this is really serious now, because it's waking him up. And he has a look in his face where he's like, he's probably the way he is, he automatically knows who it is and what's going on. But yeah, and then I thought of that too. I didn't think of the psycho scene, but you're right. I mean, just the way that it's going back and forth, it just adds to, like, you know, the confusion and the you know, the fear that's going on in the scene. So yeah, that's a really great scene.
Yeah. So then Hawkeye begs Radar to put in a call to his friend Dickie Barber just to make sure that he's okay. And then Potter shows up and says quietly, you know, after you're done put in a call to Sidney Friedman, and you know, he kind of is like, shh, you know, don't wake Hawkeye up, because Hawkeye is starting to fall asleep while he's grabbing Radar's teddy bear, which is a nice little detail. And then Hawkeye is in the swamp, and he's obviously pacing back and forth. He's really worried that he's just, you know, my friends back home are going to think I'm a ghoul. And he says, you know, how long can someone go without sleeping? And BJ has the line about 2 weeks, but you got to keep dancing, which is reference to those old-timey kind of like not charity drives, but like those dances where you would win money if you danced the longest past anybody. It sounds like absolute torture.
I was like, why would you want to do that?
It sounds awful. Somebody died doing that. I looked it up. Somebody did it for 87 hours straight, and they died right after they were done. So
yeah, there wasn't, I mean, obviously there was no internet back in the 40s and 30s. So what else can you do? You're going to dance for 87 hours.
I guess so. And then they made a movie about it too. There's a movie with they shoot horses, don't they? Which is about that, or at least that's the centerpiece of the movie. I've never seen it, but I know that's the sort of the conceit of the movie.
Okay, I've heard of the movie. I did not know. Yep. I did not know that was part of it. Okay.
Yeah, it just sounds terrible. This sounds absolutely awful. So Potter, we see Potter talking to Sydney over the phone, and Sydney says he's going to come, and he gets a little bit of wisdom from Radar, where he mentions he's always admired the way Hawkeye fights against the war.
Mm-hmm.
And Potter's like, well, no, you mean fighting the war. And Radar says, no, I mean fighting against the war. And that, he makes a joke about it. And the worse things get, the more he jokes about it. That was his way. And it's a great moment for Radar. I wonder if it's a little out of character that Radar has come up with this kind of sophisticated analysis. I don't know, but
yeah, it's okay. First of all, I was going to ask, I feel like this was cut in syndication too, or maybe I'm just misremembering. I felt like it always cut with him just acknowledging that Sydney was coming, and then it would cut to the poker game that comes next. But I could take it either way. I mean, there are times where Radar, in his innocence, there's wisdom, and he kind of has that. I mean, I do like that he recognizes, he says, fights against it where Potter fights against it by riding his horse and painting, and he fights against it by working hard and taking care of his animals. I can go either way. I don't think it's totally out of character for maybe the later seasons Radar, because he hadn't been written as immature as he would become in later seasons. But yeah, I see where you're going. I mean, I know what the writer was going for by doing it, but I kind of see Radar. I mean, he sometimes acts naive, but there's more going on there.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, I don't mean, it's not in any way a bad moment at all. It's like, wow, Radar. Okay. Radar's really, he's really kind of put some thought into this. Good for him, it's great.
Yeah. I like that, and because they never put like Potter, it gives us insight in Potter too, because he talks about David and Goliath, but it doesn't, it shows that he, and I like Radar's reaction where he says, I know about that, sir, but David wasn't afraid to go to sleep at night. So yeah, I see where you're coming from, but I'm actually glad, like I said, I mean, this was cut out. Like I like it as the scene. I mean, and again, people like us who are like so into the show, and if you've seen all the episodes, I mean, and then reading about this episode and stuff, and you see a lot of fans who say like, this is the beginning of where you see, I mean, Hawkeye, I mean, there's also the later episode with the sneezing and stuff. And then, I mean, in the final episode, spoiler, everybody, with him. But I mean, so you can kind of see the seeds being laid in there, because Hawkeye was always the one who, he did fight against it. But even like Potter says, like the jokes aren't working anymore. And that can almost be seen as, as the seasons went on, as the show got more serious, Hawkeye, I mean, he did change. So, I mean, maybe you could look back. Again, I always try to headcanon all the MASH in certain ways. And maybe you can look back and say, like, well, this is where it really started to affect him. And, I see where you're coming from. For Radar, who, is supposed to be played as so naive, and he has given this some thought. But,
Oh, sure. And again, if you want to have that scene, you don't want to have Potter like get up and walk and find somebody else to have the scene with. I mean, it's like that's bad writing, And you kind of then we cut to presumably the next night, and they're playing poker, and Radar actually bluffs Hawkeye out of a pot, which drives Hawkeye to distraction, because he says, not only does Radar beat me, he pities me besides.
I want to bring up, because you've been saying in season 5, and again, it's true, Hawkeye is my favorite character, but they weren't afraid to write him as a dick sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And this season, I know he's tired, and I know he's freaked out about what's going on, but even that, he's still kind of being a dick to Radar, because he says to him, not only does he bluff me out of a pot, but he pities me, and he's like, it's like, Radar's like, geez, like, thanks a lot, like, man.
Yeah, I mean, come on. I mean, he bluffed you. What's the big deal? Like, why can't Radar bluff you? It's a poker game. Like, what are,
radar is showing in pity. It's like, all right, like, man.
Yeah. Hawkeye's, well, I mean, this will all come to a head in the sixth season, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that then. First of all, I love that Sydney is just in the scene. There's no intro.
Yep.
We don't see him pull up. None of that. He's just there, which, again, feels very natural, very real. You know, we don't need to see him pull it. Hi, Sydney. Blah, blah, blah. Hey, Sydney Freeman. You know, we don't need to do any of that. He's just there. I mean, of course, that's how Dear Sigmund opened as well. It opened with him already there. And I love, again, it feels so natural that he's just there. He's part of the gang. You know who he is at this point. We don't need to go through the ritual of having him show up every time.
Yeah. And again, they can play off the familiarity that not only the cast has with him, but that the audience has too. Exactly. I mean, you could just have him there and there's no explanation needed. It can go right from there.
Yep. So Hawkeye goes out for a stroll and Sydney follows him. And Hawkeye even says, you know, it's fine with me if you come along as your couch has wheels on it. And as good as this episode is, and this is a great episode, this scene here, this extended sequence is like next level great.
Yes,
it's mostly the acting, but also the writing, but it's the directing. I mean, geez, I guess those are the elements that make a good show. But these two actors have such chemistry, the two Allens.
Yes.
And their dialogue, again, presumably courtesy of Bert Prelutsky, is so, to me, unforced. It does not feel like these are actors or a script that is getting to a predetermined point that they need to get to. This feels like a genuine conversation these two people are having. It is, to me, one of the most naturalistic scenes in the entire series.
Yes.
And I feel like it's the kind of thing where this scene has so much in it, so much character going on that I always feel like, oh, this is like a 10-minute scene. And no, it's about a minute and a half.
Exactly. I mean, just the way it starts, I love the way, and like you said, I mean, they're so natural with each other, but the way Sydney is kind of trying to joke with him and you just see Hawkeye's hand go on him, like stop him. And he's probably, I mean, you can't really tell, but he's probably like squeezing his arm a little bit, stopping him. And they feel comfortable enough to do that as characters, but also as actors. And even the way that he says to him, you know, he just offhandedly asked, did Potter call you? And he says, would you be angry if you did? And he said, no, I'd appreciate his concern. I love that moment. It's, again, it's not like it's this huge moment, but there's so much, the way that it just shows you how much respect Hawkeye has for Potter, but like how much his relationship with him has grown, and who knows how long he's supposed to, it's now the second season that they're together. But everything you said about, again, it feels like when you bring this episode up, it feels like it should be a Sydney episode, because these 5 minutes or whatever feel like, not that it feels long, but it feels like this is the bulk of the episode.
Yep.
So much is going on in just these 5 minutes. And it's just, like you said, it's the actors, it's the writing, it's the way, it's at night, but it's good that they did it at night, because they're probably obviously on set. They're not on the ranch filming, but you can't really... I mean, you could tell because we know from watching it, but like you can't really tell. So it's just like the whole setting of it and the way that it's staged. And like you said, they are totally, the charisma between both actors, it's great. And it's just one of the best scenes in the whole series.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that I like about it is, and it reminds me of the scenes that Alan Alda had with Blythe Danner in The More I See You, which was the episode I went on and on and on about last season. But I feel like that as much as what you're hearing those two actors say to each other, there's just as much that you're not hearing. And the show is respecting the audience to be intelligent and be paying attention. You know, before our audiences could be looking at their phones, you know, while doing three other things. They're respecting the audience to understand that this is a conversation between adults and there were things not being said, but being understood between these two adults that you have to pick up on. And this something else I love about it is that Sydney is, as far as we can tell, being the psychiatrist, he's using his style of psychiatry the way he normally does. Like, he is treating Hawkeye kind of like any other patient, because that's Sidney's technique. And I think perceive that Hawkeye is a little irritated at that. Like, he's almost like, you know, he wants Sidney to take him more seriously a little, because mm-hmm. Hawkeye is so gravely concerned about this. And, you know, he makes jokes. I mean, there's a moment where Sidney uses the word for shimmeled, which is a Hebrew term, a Hebrew word. And for years I used that word because I just love the sound of it. Yeah. It just sounded so wonderfully old timey, for shimmeled. And people would be like, "What? What did you just say?" And I learned it from Sidney Friedman. Exactly. It just sounds so great. But it's like Sidney is drawing Hawkeye out, and he is treating him like a patient. And I think Hawkeye is kind of almost like, I want you to be more serious about this, but Sidney's going to do, Sidney's going to be Sidney.
Yep.
You know? And so I love it that when Hawkeye finally kind of gets, maybe not frustrated, but when he just gets baseline serious and he says, "Am I going crazy?"
Yeah.
And then Sidney finally realizes, okay, this guy is really, really worried. And then he finally just says very forcefully, "No," you know, like, okay. No, and it's kind of what you were saying. This scene doesn't feel long, but it feels like a full meal mm-hmm. that you kind of can't believe it's only the half of the second act of the show.
Yeah. And the way he says no, like he's, like you said, it's forceful, but it's not mean. And it's it's caring in a way. Like, not, he's not making fun of him, but he's, and not laughing, but he's almost like, cause he knows that he's not. I mean, he even says to him, he says, "You're probably the most sane person I know." He says, "If you were, the fact is, if you were crazy, you'd sleep like a baby." Mm-hmm. But like, just the way he says no to him, cause he's already in his head thought, he probably knows, you know, cause he walks him through it, but he probably already knows this is what he's going through. But he needs him to see it. But like you said, he's saying to him like no, and I think he knows that it's going to make him feel better when he tells him, because that's what he wants to hear. But then he obviously walks him through it too. Like you said, it's like a full meal, and it's only those 5 minutes, but it's just the whole conversation and just the way, you know, it. I never get tired of watching it. I watched it 3 times before we did this, and it's not like something like, "Oh, I watch this again just because I want to have everything in my head." It's just like you said, it's just a masterclass in writing, in directing, in staging, in everything. Just the way it feels and the way it's done, it's just great.
Yeah, I think, and also I think you're right that having it at night, I get part of it is maybe to hide the fact that they're on the set. You know, they're mm-hmm. not, but also just gives it a more, you know, unsettling feel, because it's late, maybe, you know, they should be up. And Alan Alda looks very tired. You know, the makeup they've given him, they've kind of given him more like bags under his eyes, and his hair's a little more disheveled and stuff like that. And I love Sidney's analysis about that. The dreams are peaceful. It's the war invading them that turns them, you know, and he's like, "You know, I'm not getting very far." He goes, "You're making it all the way back to Crabapple Cove." You know, and you're like, yeah, it's, you know, and then on top of all that, as great as this scene is, the thing that I think is even more transcendent about this episode is that it doesn't resolve.
No,
it doesn't resolve. And, you know, people in entertainment, especially I think a lot of people in America, we like tidy resolutions. We don't mm-hmm. like ambiguity. That's death to, you know, a lot of creative work. Because audiences don't like, everything's got to be answered now. Everything's got to be, you know, every character we meet has to have a prequel devoted to them explaining why they are the way they are. Oh, let's find out why Michael Myers is a murderer. I don't care. He's a murderer. What difference does it make? You know, mm-hmm. the shark's a shark in Jaws. I don't need a prequel to tell me that the shark is angry about something. I love that this episode just ends unresolved. You know, Sidney just says, "There's a lot of pain here, Hawkeye, and you can't dream it away." It's like, that's it. Like, you're just going to have to suffer through this, man. No other way out of it.
Yeah. And I, you know, he still says to him, "You have a hell of a war side matter." I think he's happy that he's that he talked it out with him and explained to him, and he might realize, you know, I might still have it, but now I know why I'm having these dreams. And again, it's treating the audience as adults, where it's like you said, I mean, every sitcom back then or even now, you want everything wrapped up and everything goes back to the start at, you know, after 30, after 20, whatever, 25 minutes. Now it's probably 21 minutes. But I mean, it is, it's saying that this is why it's happening. It might still happen. Now you know why it's happening, and it's something you're going to have to work through, and you can, but and now you can fight it because you know why it's happening to you. But it, yeah, it's great. It's not like he's like, oh, great, I, you know, my mind's clear. Now I'm never going to have bad dreams again. Now, you know, they never kind of bring it up. But again, I mean, you could also headcanon this and say, like, this is where Hawkeye starts, where he's going to have other problems where Sydney has to come and talk to him. So, but, you know, this is something we all have to go through. I mean, there's things that we all have to deal with, and sometimes we deal with them, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we feel good, sometimes we feel bad, and that's just how it is. And that's, I feel like MASH, you know, that's why we love it so much. There wasn't always easy answers. The show didn't always end with a freeze frame of everybody smiling and hugging and stuff. There were times where it ended and, you know, you were like, okay, well, this is stuff we're going to have to go through, or this person is, this is something that somebody's going to have to live with for the rest of their life. And that's real life. It's, you know, and they respect the viewer enough that they can pull that off and that we're going to accept it. And that's what makes this episode even better, because you don't want to know that, okay, now I'm cured, or now,
yeah,
you know,
yep.
I mean, that's all of us.
Yeah.
Deal with things.
Yeah. They've come to some sort of resolution, but there is no promise from Sydney that the dreams are not going to continue. And as you said, we never saw them again, but we can assume that these things trailed off, but they didn't stop. And I remember just being like, even as a child, almost when I got old enough to sort of appreciate the art form, as opposed to just taking it all in as it was coming, just being like, wow, they really didn't resolve that episode. That's pretty amazing. You know, that's just like, that's really cool. I've as an adult, I've come to enjoy stories that have unresolved endings if it works for the story. You know, you're like, well, no, this has to end in a way that's kind of a little unsatisfying if you need everything all wrapped up. But I kind of like that it's just like, oh, okay, we don't really know how this is going to wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, and in all honesty, and I personally, I've never been to a psychiatrist, and I've read other people say, I can't remember who it was who said, like, everybody should go and see a psychiatrist at least once in their life. And now, like, in the times we're living in now, it's more out there that, you know, before it was like, oh, you can never admit that people were going to see a psychiatrist because that, you know, people will think you're crazy, or people will think you're weak or whatever. I mean, one, I would be spoiled now if I went to a psychiatrist because I'd want them to be Sydney Friedman.
Yeah. Oh, but, completely.
You know, yeah, I'd go in expecting it's going to be fun. Like, you know, I might be talking about my problems, but we're going to have a good time. But I mean, that's real life too with a psychiatrist. You're not going to go five times. And like after five times, it's like, okay, well, you know, I went and we talked and now everything's resolved and I feel so much better. I mean, you know, there's people who go years and years and years,
their whole life. Yeah. I mean, their whole life.
And there's nothing, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. Maybe, and that's what they need, but you know, these things aren't just tied up in a bow. Sometimes, you know, people need to work out their stuff and it's going to take a while. So yeah, I mean, it's not resolved and that's great. That's what, like I said, that's what elevates this episode. It's, you know, it's just adds another layer to it. I mean, it's going to always be there. And like, you know, this was what, 1976. So, I mean, the Vietnam War was over, but I mean, the way he says it, like, you know, there's still, you know, it's still talking about that kind of stuff and talking about war in general, where he says there's a lot of suffering. And, you know, you're not going to be able to escape that. And that's, you know, that's a powerful statement to think about. I mean, in the current times we're in now with the war going on the other side of the world, I mean, it's there. It is. I mean, because it's not in your backyard, you don't think about it. But I mean, if you're in the middle, like, as Hawkeye says in this episode, you know, it's one thing to be in the middle of a shooting gallery, which happens, but then also with psychological problems, to be attacked from within has got to be really scary too. So then you're getting it on two fronts. So yeah, it's great that it's not resolved. and he's going to, you know, that he's going to have to deal with it and figure it out and live with it, you know, his way.
There are a lot of people that we are all suffering under, and we'd be better off had they gotten some therapy. Yeah. We don't need to name them, but we know who they are. They're just people who clearly have deep emotional problems, and they are inflicting those problems on the rest of us.
Yeah,
because those things are unresolved. You know,
unfortunately, we pay the price for a lot of those people. Unfortunately, so
yeah. But Sydney finds a way to, in the most Sydney-esque manner possible, ends the therapy with a little game of mind basketball, and him and Hawkeye enter right into it. And of course, you know, it's kind of the classic improv thing of yes anding, because, you know, these two have to pretend that there is a ball, and they're pretending that you know, that they're grabbing it out of each other's hands and stuff like that. And it's a really great job. And of course, Radar and Klinger see this and are shocked by it, and we lead to the great Klinger button of saying, is there any wonder why I can't get a Section 8, you know, if you want to be crazy, you know, this kind of crazy is, look at the kind of crazy that's going on in this unit. Yeah.
The line.
Yeah. You got to stand in line. And then it even leads to the button scene where Klinger thinks it's all a scam, and he says, is Friedman buying it? You know, the shtick, the routine, you know, I've been kicking myself for not coming with early, you know, the sleepwalking, the blood curdling screams in the middle of the night. And of course, Hawkeye, you know, just goes along with it and does I guess, presumably a Napoleon imitation. Where he says, you know, maybe Josephine, I'm as sane as you. And Klinger just kind of looks like, what? You know, I don't think he really gets the reference or whatever. Hawkeye going to be Hawkeye.
I do like when he comes out of the tent, like you could tell he's kind of like stretching his arms, like he looks like he finally got a good night's sleep.
Yes. And
he doesn't look as weary as he's looked in the whole episode. And I think it's like one of the first times I was watching it again, and he has kind of like his shirt buttoned, because you never, like, Hawkeye all through the seasons always had like his shirt open with the t-shirt under it. So he kind of just looks like neater and more put together. And I think it's kind of,
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah. I think they're kind of conveying that he finally got a good night's sleep, but I do love that. I love that button scene with him and Klinger. I think that's great. And it's just a nice denouement after the more serious type of episode to end it on a laugh like that, which is good.
Yeah, it's nice. Except so that's Hawk's Nightmare. It's like a masterpiece of an episode. And just, you know, Bert Proleski, again, man, the guy knew how to write MASH, you know. He just did. And it's just a marvelous show from top to bottom. So Mike, thanks for coming and talking about the show. It's just an absolutely fantastic episode. So did you have a favorite line or joke from the show?
Well, like I said, I mean, this episode has really, there are just a lot of good soliloquies. There's a lot of good like scenes and lines, and but for like a funny, I mean, like I said, I love the line when Hawkeye's talking about his dad, but for a funny line, it's in that last episode when Klinger is questioning him and saying like, I, you know, the scam, I can't believe I didn't figure it out. And when he says to him, you know, and he says, when he says, you don't have to get dressed up, he's like, and you don't need to rely on the fickle whims of fashion. And he says, I doff my chapeau to you. That always makes me laugh. So that, as a funny line, that is my favorite funny line. As just a line of the episode, when Hawkeye's talking about his dad, and also when he asks Sydney if Potter called him, and he tells him that he would appreciate his concern. Those are lines that I've just always remembered over the 11 years that I love those lines and those exchanges between the characters. So
yeah, the Potter line especially is terrific. Mm-hmm. Just the unforced Potter call you, just that unforced way of saying it. It's just great. Yeah. My favorite line is actually, it's not even that funny a line, but it's from that scene where Sydney makes a very astute observation and Hawkeye applauds him. And then he says in that mock surprise, hey, you're pretty good. And then Sydney says, thank you. For my next trick, I'll invent sibling rivalry, which is a great. Just him taking credit for, like, Freud terms or whatever. So it's just, again, man, it's, you know, Alan Arbus, the Sydney Friedman, just, you know, no bad. I mean, there's no episode with Sydney Friedman that isn't worth watching, because he's just such a great character.
And I'm not going to be, I'm telling you, I will not be able to go to a psychiatrist, because I'm spoiled by Sydney Friedman.
Yeah.
They would just not live up to my expectations.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, this guy's not funny. You're like, what are you doing? This isn't good at all. Yeah, totally. Well, Mike, thank you so much for coming back again this season to talk about this great episode. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Season 4 and 5. I mean, these have been great. I mean, everything's great, and it's always great talking about MASH. But these have been especially great. These are just amazing seasons, and it's always fun to be on MASHcast. So I thank you.
Thank you very much. So why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Oh, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. You know, I don't know why you would want to go on Facebook and Twitter now. I mean, come on, just watch MASH. Because
please tell them your handle on Twitter. I do this every year. I love your handle.
I know you do. It's this lightsaber kills fascists.
It never gets old for me. So, again, thanks so much, Mike. I really appreciate it. And, of course, everybody, you can find this show on Twitter at MASH477Cast. You can find all the back episodes on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. By the way, if you love this show, even if you just like it, take a couple of minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave the show a 5-star review. I would very much appreciate it. It would help balance out some of the more negative reviews, let's say, we have for the show. So I would very much appreciate it if you could take the time to give the show a review over on Apple Podcasts.
Hi.
And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, let's go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big salute to Daniel Ulrich, Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Dan Peel, Britt Schramm, Mike Thomas, Michael Porter, Joe Perino, and Billy Shulman for their support of MASHcast. I very much appreciate it. So that's going to do it. We will see you later. But until then, that is all.
Toby, I do not owe you $37. Listen to me, will you? The sled was... Yes, I borrowed the money. I admit that, but I paid you back years ago. Why would I lie? Okay, Toby, fine. If that's how you feel about it, come over here and collect.